once you get airborne then and get up from the rendezvous, then you, well, really, you just take it a step at a time and you try and accomplish the thing that you're doing then to the best of your ability without really worrying about that 15 and 20 minutes from now when you're going to be in the target area.
From the sprawling flight deck of the 7th Fleet attack aircraft carrier Hancock, a strike is launched against the Kep airfield in North Vietnam. Lieutenant Junior Grade Roger Van Dyke was flying flak support.
Our job was to go on about 15 minutes ahead of time and hit some known these known flak sites. So when the major strike group got there just behind us, that we would have the flak sites quieted down. As we approached the target about 6 miles out, they really started opening up on us. One of our members in the flight got hit, and I saw him go out of sight over to the left, and then just immediately afterwards, I took a hit. At the time, I really didn't, I wasn't sure how bad I was hit. I just more or less felt kind of a bump. By this time, I had reached the rolling point over the airfield and started my dive. About halfway down through the dive, I realized that I didn't have any control response on my control, so I went ahead and pointed my pipper to target and pickled the best I could there, and then started a frantic pullout. I bottomed out, I guess, about 2,000 feet, and then headed back up north again. As it turned out, I took a hit up in the vertical stabilizer and went through the rudder package and bled all my hydraulic fluid overboard. It was really quite a ride trying to get back, as I had no control except with the trim. Well, the only difficult problem with coming back aboard the ship was that I had no flaps or no speed brakes, and the stick was very stiff, so it almost required both hands on the stick to be able to fly the airplane. Once I got back to the ship, I was able to get my gear down after some difficulty, and then finally was able to trap aboard.
Lieutenant Commander Ken Jurgensen of Lemoore, California, was flying with the main strike group.
The weather was not too bad. Visibility was 15 to 20 miles. There were, as we got over inland, crossing the coast, there were some buildups and a few clouds, but nothing to really mar the navigation or the scenic view, if you want. And we knew that up to reaching a certain point in toward this reservoir, that we weren't really in danger of anything except if they sent the MiGs out after us. We were too high for the AAA. So really, it was not too much sweat going in there. Of course, as we approached the reservoir area, which is, again was our checkpoint to turn into to Kep airfield there, you knew you were getting into the area where you can start looking for things. And so everyone started bouncing the aircraft around, changing the direction of flight, altitude, to throw off any of the ground radar that was on your fire control radar. Once we turned at the reservoir, or just approached the reservoir, it seemed like the whole area just came alive with black puffs, gray puffs, 57, 85 millimeter. Made the turn at the reservoir, again, jinxing moderately to stay out of the AAA and to at least try and throw them off. And so we were actually pretty busy there for about 3 to 4 minutes getting into the target on and off. It was about the hottest that I've ever seen it really over a target, but in terms of AAA, you could almost put out another weather forecast saying it became overcast. You almost couldn't see down through it. Mostly the black puffs, which were the 85 millimeters, it was the heaviest 85 millimeter concentration I've ever seen over there, really. My particular target was a storage area located on the southeastern part of the runway, between the runway and the southern revetment areas. My two wingmen, their targets were the revetted areas right next to the storage area. The flight as a whole overall was very effective, really. I pulled off my target and looked back, and I couldn't tell where my bombs had gone, but I saw my wingman's bombs land right in the revetment that their target was, with large orange flames and smoke coming out of there, which indicated that they hit whatever was in there. How about MiGs with fuel in them?
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet and was presented as a public service of this station. Navy journalist Niels and Ross speaking.
One of these the biggest impression on myself was the day that we got hit and lost two men on our boat. That was the first time that I had done a scene in the action myself. And pretty gruesome.
Winding its tortuous route from the South China Sea to the teeming port city of Saigon, South Vietnam, is the Long Tao River. Wide and deep enough to accommodate the largest ocean-going cargo traffic, the Long Tao River is the waterway over which flows all the waterborne supplies for the war effort in South Vietnam. The Long Tao River is a favorite target of the Viet Cong. The primary job of the Navy's Mine Squadron 11, Detachment Alpha, is sweeping for mines planted by the Viet Cong along the Long Tao. Because of their effectiveness in keeping the river safe for its cargo traffic, the minesweepers are often targets for VC snipers. Kenneth Bracey of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, is a fireman aboard one of the minesweepers. He recalls what happened the first time he saw action.
We were on our regular sweep, and we were on our last pass before we came in and secured for the day. And we had just turned around and started coming back along the bank with our chain bottom drag. Sniper fire opened up from the beach, and I had just switched to watch. I was up on the bridge. This other seaman came out to relieve me. In fact, he relieved me kind of early, about 5 minutes early, and I said something to him about it. He said, "Go ahead, go back to the gun tub." So, okay. So I went back to the gun tub, and just as I set my feet in there, bang, bang, started opening up. My first reaction was just to duck. And then I was down about 3, 4, 5 seconds, came back up, started looking for a target, because then it started opening up automatic weapons fire. When I was looking for a target, I saw this gun barrel sticking out of this bush, and it looked like a 30 caliber. And it was smoking pretty good, so it was really going. So I put my 50 rod on it, sent traces in there. I thought I was burning him up. He didn't stop, so he must, I do the conclusion he was pretty well dug in. As we went down, firing slacked off, we turned around, and about this point, the gun, the barrel had, couldn't take the heat anymore, it had warped, it wouldn't chamber around anymore, so I hollered up to POIC, he's in charge of the boat, and told him that I was going to move to a gun down on deck, that this gun had just went out. That was when I first saw that somebody had been hit. I didn't know it up to this time. I saw our engineman had been hit, and you could see that he was killed, he was dead. And he said, "No, don't go to a gun." He said, "Get me a first aid kit." So I came down in the pilot house, grabbed first aid kit, and went up the ladder to the bridge, and then that's when I saw this other seaman. The one that had relieved me early was dead too. And that's the thing that, it's kind of eerie, because if he hadn't relieved me early, that'd have been me, because he was standing in the same place I was, and he was shot in the back.
In addition to flak jackets and helmets, the minesweepers have some built-in protection for crew members against VC snipers.
On our gun positions in the boat, we have armor plating around us in the 50 caliber gun tub, which gives us pretty good protection against weapons of sniper type, small arms, things like that. My biggest fear is not being able to see them. Whenever you get shot at, you can't see them. You're shooting blind. You just gotta spray the area in hopes that you can see them. But these snipers, recently around here, they've stepped up the program with these starlight scopes, which enable them to see at night. And that's the bad thing. That's bad, because they can zero right in on you. They don't use tracers at night, so you can't tell where they're at, so you can't fire back. You just hope that you hit them.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet and was presented as a public service of this station. Navy journalist Nielsen Ross speaking.
We're trained. trained for search and rescue, so my first reaction was to see what we could do to help. My wingman at this time, he didn't have any radio. And this complicated problems a little bit, but he came on in anyway.
Lieutenant Perry Gard, a Navy Sky Raider pilot from St. Petersburg, Florida, was returning to the 7th Fleet carrier Hancock in the Gulf of Tonkin when a distress call came in from a crippled American aircraft over North Vietnam. Moments later, another aircraft reported that the plane had crashed, but that he had seen two parachutes. Lieutenant Gard and his wingman volunteered their assistance, and when they arrived at the scene, the area coordinator notified Lieutenant Gard that he had been designated on-scene commander for the rescue.
I broadcast and asked the survivors to please say something on his radio and let me know where he was. And using this method, we were able to pinpoint their position. It was on top of a hill. It was about 400 feet high. The entire area was covered with very intense vegetation and forest, and it made it impossible to see the survivors. However, talking to them, we were able to determine that they were all right, but that there were unfriendly troops in the area who were firing at them. At this point, the area search and rescue coordinator informed me that I had a flight of F-4Cs orbiting overhead the scene and were awaiting my call if I needed them. So I called and asked if any of them had any ordnance aboard that would be suitable for use in the search and rescue mission. And one of them replied that he did. So I asked him to come down. Initially, the survivors had indicated that they were drawing fire off a ridge line to the north. I asked the F-4 pilot if he'd please lay his ordnance up the side of the ridge, and he did. He walked him right up the side of the ridge, making his runs parallel to the ridge, and we never got another shot out of that ridge. The pilots were in such a position that the helicopters could not get in to rescue them. And I asked them on the radio to move to positions on the hill that we could get them out. I'd noticed that from directly atop of the hill that the pilots were now on the side of, I received automatic weapons fire. I didn't feel yet we could commit the helicopter and take the chance on him being shot down by this automatic weapons sight, so I asked the F-4 once again to drop some ordnance on the top of the hill. The pilot went in and he put it right on target, and we never got another shot off that hill. And we asked the helicopter to please come in and attempt to pick them up. So I asked the pilot with the greatest amount of signaling devices to please indicate his position to us, and he did. And the helicopter immediately saw it and began to approach him. The North Vietnamese used one of their standard tricks and let him get into the hover and then started shooting. The helicopter immediately picked up and left. All aircraft were almost out of ordnance at this point, but we did have some rockets and some guns. And so we fired what we had and asked the helicopter if he'd mind trying it again. He said no, he'd be glad to. And to support him, with seven airplanes in the area, we were able to always have one aircraft pointed at the hill. The enemy didn't know we didn't have any ordnance, and I expect that he kept his head down whenever he saw an airplane heading towards him. In any event, the helicopter went in, picked up the first man, and got out. The helicopter then proceeded into the area and with some difficulty found the remaining survivor. He was hidden in the bottom of a bomb crater, but after about 10 minutes of jockeying around, we finally found him, put him aboard the helicopter, and the last thing I saw was a pilot dangling below the helicopter as the helicopter flew off. As it turned out, we'd been in this area for an hour and a half. The helicopter had made this pickup with mechanical difficulties, which made it virtually impossible. But he still did it.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet and was presented as a public service of this station. Navy journalist Niels and Ross speaking.
that's what it is. It's a miracle that we really get them out that fast. But like I said, I've seen it done 6 or 7 times, and it runs smoothly.
Hospitalman Second Class Samuel D. Botero of Onawa, Iowa, is a Navy corpsman attached to the battalion aid station at Dong Ha in the I Corps in the Republic of Vietnam. During the early part of his Vietnam tour, he was in the field with the Marines.
My company participated in Operation Allegheny and Operation Golden Fleece, and then when we moved up here north, we took part in segments of Operation Prairie, too. That's about all I caught when I was out there.
Treating casualties in the field can be one of the toughest jobs imaginable, particularly when there are many wounded and the corpsman is under fire.
It's more or less on the spur of the moment. I mean, you see a man that's hurt real bad, and you try to take care of him, you know, as fast as you can. You stop his bleeding, or if he's having trouble breathing, so you take care of that, and you try to get to the next man. The basic thing out there is just treat as many as you can, as fast as you can, and give them all the aid you can.
Navy Corpsman Botero is now working at Delta Med, a battalion aid station located 7 miles south of the DMZ, and handles mass casualties as they come in from the field. After treatment, the wounded may be returned to their units. If not, they may be sent on to one of the in-country military hospitals or the Navy hospital ship's repose and sanctuary off the coast of Vietnam. Some of the more seriously wounded may even wind up being returned to the States. The treatment they receive at Delta Med, however, is perhaps the most important. Apart from hurried first aid measures performed by the corpsman with them in combat, this is the first medical attention they'll get. It has to be right, and it has to be quick.
In the last 6 months, I'd say that we have treated here at least 2,000 casualties, if not more than that. I mean, I've seen all kinds come through here, head wounds, abdominal wounds, and as far as experience goes for a corpsman, the doctors here even say that a corpsman over here at this medical battalion gets more experience than an intern back in the States, because we have so much more responsibility here. I mean, the doctors can't be with every casualty, because we only have 8 doctors here, and when 160 men come in all at one time, you know, I mean, the corpsman's got to be on the ball. He's got to know what he's doing, and while practice on mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and things like this, you know, and reinforcing battle dressings and putting splints on, things like this, you know, things that actually a doctor really should do, but we have to do here when it can be life or death. I mean, we have to do it. I mean, that's all there is to it.
When casualties arrive in large numbers at Delta Med, the situation seems chaotic, and the uninitiated might wonder how the Navy corpsmen and doctors can possibly cope with the task.
I've seen it done 6 or 7 times, and I marvel at each time, because it starts out, you know, it looks so disorganized. A person that would look in, it looks so disorganized, and you feel like just shaking your head, and, you know, oh, you can't take care of all these people. But somehow it seems to work out. Everybody pulls together. It seems like in a time of crisis, no matter what differences you have, when it's slack, everything is forgotten, and the only thing that matters is that Marine that's out in the field. I mean, he's coming in, and we want to give him the best chance possible. And we take him in there, we put him on the stretcher, and we strip all his clothes off, we examine his wounds, we wrap him up, we stop the bleeding, we start IVs. We aid them in breathing, and then we just evac them out. We call up planes, and so we get them out of here very fast. It's really very amazing. I mean, it's a miracle. That's what it is. It's a miracle.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet and was presented as a public service of this station. Navy journalist Niels and Ross speaking.
Did not reach the main fuel tanks prior to the time I ejected. On the way down, I observed the aircraft spiraling down toward the water, and it did blow up before it hit the water. However, I think I would have had another 30 seconds.
Lieutenant Commander Hugh McGee of Fairfield, Connecticut, is a Navy pilot with Attack Squadron 146 aboard the 7th Fleet carrier Constellation. He flies the A-4 Skyhawk, the Navy's smallest attack bomber.
It's very tough and durable. I think that's been proven here in Vietnam. A lot of people have been hit pretty hard in this aircraft and brought it back to the ship. When it's hit in a hydraulic system, unlike other aircraft, we have a backup fly-by-wire system, so we lose all our hydraulics and still control the aircraft. It's a big selling point with the Skyhawk people.
Recently, Lieutenant Commander McGee and his section were on their way to a strike over North Vietnam when they were ordered to divert and go to the assistance of a downed Navy A-6 pilot.
Any strike can be diverted at any time to aid a downed pilot. And this is very comforting to me and other pilots. The strike I was on was a major strike heading toward a target, and we were immediately diverted to help this pilot. He was down about a quarter mile off the coast at Vinh, and he was being mortared in the water. They were firing mortars on him from the beach, hoping to get him before our rescue people got in. We got in the vicinity of Vinh, and we observed a couple of small boats coming out of the river at Vinh, and a couple more from an inlet about 5 miles north of there, heading toward the pilot, trying to pick him up. This is North Vietnamese. We immediately started runs on these boats, and after the first plane pulled off, he did not try and hit him. He just dropped the bomb near him just to change his mind, and sure enough, he did. He headed back to the coast, and we had no more trouble with the boats. However, the mortars were still firing off the beach, so our next job was to go in and suppress the mortar fire. And we couldn't exactly see where the mortars were coming from, although we knew, had a pretty good idea. And we were just dropping a couple of bombs at a time, just trying to keep their heads down and make their aim bad so the helo could come in and pick up the A-6 pilot. The skipper section pulled off, and I rolled my section in, dropped a couple of bombs, pulled up. As I went through 6,000 feet climbing in a port turn, I took a hit right under the cockpit, just cut the control cables, fuel lines, oxygen lines, and the aircraft caught on fire. We have a set policy in the States. Anytime an aircraft is on fire, you jump out of it right away. Well, over here, if your aircraft is on fire and you're over the beach, unless you have some indication of an imminent explosion, we stay with the aircraft. It's a calculated risk. So I immediately headed east, out over the water. I got about 4 miles. The engine quit. Was advised by my wingman the aircraft was completely engulfed in flames. At that time, I ejected. And while I was coming down in the chute, the helo was in to pick up the A-6 pilot. I landed in the water. I was in the water about 5 minutes, and the helo was on his way over. Picked me up, just minor injuries, and brought us both back to the destroyer, which the helo was operating off of.
Once aboard the rescue destroyer, Lieutenant Commander McGee received a rousing welcome.
Oh, they were just tickled silly to just be able to be a part of a rescue. We have these search and rescue types all up and down the Gulf just waiting for a chance to pick up pilot. And when they do get one, they just treat you like a king. They're a little bit more remote from the war, and this is their way of being in a war, and it's a great way.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet and was presented as a public service of this station. Navy journalist Nielsen Ross speaking.